Let me start again. I'm AJ. I am the product manager for System Center Endpoint Protection, formerly known as Forefront Endpoint Protection, and System Center Configuration Manager. Together, it's client management and security. So I work on those technologies. And so I'm happy to be here with Chris to talk about Windows 8 security technologies, as well as all the peripheral technologies that will help you secure your desktop.
All right, so let's dive into it. So we've got a pretty broad agenda because we're talking about kind of the overall strategy of what we're doing at Microsoft. And kind of what that means is we're going to talk about how all of these products, you know, there's some of them are over in AJ's group, we've got System Center, we've got things in the client, we've got things in server, things in Office, et cetera. There's a broad set of technologies. And so we're going to try to help you make sense of it so that you can come away with a kind of a holistic view of how we're protecting everything. And it's a 200-level session, right? We can't get into the details of that broad array of things, but I think you'll walk away with a good idea of how these technologies fit together and how they give you that holistic security view. And so what we'll do is we'll talk about a number of things. We'll set some context in the beginning, and we'll talk about how we're modeling our approach to security. We'll talk about what we're calling flexible work styles. So flexible work styles, if you haven't seen the campaign yet, are the scenarios that we're building all our features around. And so we've worked with people like yourself saying, you know, what are the user scenarios within your environment? And we came up with a series of scenarios. We call them the flexible work styles. And so if you're looking for more information on that, you can see that up on Springboard and understand what the individual scenarios are. We'll then talk about configuration management, which is kind of where we start our protection story. We'll talk about how we protect and manage against threats. And we just actually came out of a session on malware resistance, so we'll cover a lot of things we talked about there, introduce maybe hopefully a couple of new things as well. We'll talk about how we protect sensitive data on devices and how we're going to secure access to resources. And then, of course, devices. And so, as maybe seen if you attended our last session, security is obviously in the news, and it's moved away from script kiddies with acts of vandalism on users' PCs. It's now major attacks on users, organizations, national interests, etc. And so the stakes have become very high, and we have a very, very sophisticated class of people who are doing the black hat work these days. And so you can see we have a number of news stories here. We just talked about in our last session the threats of botnets and some of the things we're doing to address that. But in addition to that, we also are investing quite a bit in protecting data. So you see a story there kind of on the upper second to the right about losing a lot of money due to data loss. In fact, if you're familiar, if you're in the state of California, you're in healthcare. Is anybody state of California healthcare? Okay, no. Well, then what you don't know is that if you lose patient records, you're up for millions of dollars of fines. In fact, just recently, you may have seen stories about a particular organization that I won't name where they had a fine applied to them about $1.5 million because they lost 60 patient records. And that story occurred because they were creating backups of their disks, and they put those secure backups in a locker with no lock. And for some reason, they went missing. And sadly for them, they had a record of these, and somebody found out that they had a record of something that no longer existed within their organization, and then the fine got applied. So anyway, they got burned by their excellent record keeping and terrible security on devices. But at any rate, there's a lot at stake there. Another thing that's interesting is a firm in Michigan actually went out and randomly tried to hack some accounts. And they were trying to see how strong people's passwords were, and they found out that people had passwords that were password 123456, et cetera. So all these terribly weak passwords on sites like, you know, Amazon or you name it. And what they found also is that when they hacked a user's password on one site, they could also get into their accounts on all their other sites. So once they figured out what they're using on Facebook, they knew Amazon, they knew eBay, they knew et cetera. And so this is a terrible, terrible problem. And of course, that's something that we're concerned about at Microsoft. So anyway, I think that gives you a sense of some of the stories. And so Microsoft has been in the industry of security for a long time. And if you've been with us on that journey, you've seen that we've learned a lot. You'll probably remember with XP that we had a big wake-up call to security, right? And we made some big changes in SP2, and then we made some more changes in Vista, And those were hard changes. You remember the Vista release. We made those in the interest of security, so we did the right thing, but it was rough. But then with Windows 7, things got pretty good, right? We have a great operating system there. But the threats have changed since Windows 7, and with Windows 8, we need to get ahead of some of the threats that we foresee, and we need to address some of the threats that that happened that we weren't aware of. And so with Windows 8, we'll be handling just that. So there are a number of trends that are making security complex in people's environments. One of the biggest is consumerization of IT. So if you're familiar with this, you'll know how challenging this is. And the reality is we're advancing our software to address this, but there's still a lot of work to do. There's lots of great things in System Center 2012 to address those, et cetera. But it's still very, very challenging, right? We have a situation where increasingly users are bringing their own devices into their environments. Those devices oftentimes are not managed, domain controlled. And this offers all sorts of challenges with policy. How do I know that my data is secure, et cetera? And so consumerization is a very, very difficult challenge. And then when we look at the advanced and persistent threats, we've seen some very, very scary ones recently. If you're familiar with Flame, who's familiar with the details of Flame, just out of curiosity? Okay, so not everyone. So I'll share a little detail on that. One of the things that's interesting about Flame is is a low-level rootkit plus a lot more. And what's scary about Flame is it turns a device into a surveillance system. It takes screenshots. It records your voice if there's a mic. If there's a camera on it, it starts watching you. It watches your email. I mean, pretty much anything that's going on that device is analyzed. And we don't know everything about it. In fact, Kaspersky said basically that it's going to take them 10 years to really truly understand what this is doing. And the thing that's so scary about it is that these advanced persistent threats are flying low and very slow, low in the stack of the device, and very slow. So you can imagine all the surveillance data that Flame's taking. How is it sending that out of the network without being detected? Somehow they found a way. I don't know. Obviously, advanced compression techniques, slowly moving the information around. But it was able to evade what I assume were network intrusion systems, network analysis systems that were in their environments. And so these are very scary threats. And in the case of Flame, I'm sure they had $1 million budget plus to build this. And so we're seeing organized crime or nation states more heavily involved in this. So we want to address that. And of course, we have the expanding importance of identity. So identity management, of course, has always been a challenge over time. And now as we move into the cloud, it offers whole new sets of challenges. And so that's another area, another trend that's affecting us. And then government interests are increasingly get involved. So there's a number of compliance standards that you're familiar with. Many of you are trying maybe are compliant with FIPS. That's just one example of a United States federal compliance standard. But they're increasingly getting more and more involved in security, right? We've seen discussions here in the U.S. about should an employer be able to ask for Facebook profile information as part of the interview process. And so there's a lot of legislation, a lot of discussion, and a lot of government engagement in these issues. And I'm sure there will be many, many more regulations that come out and affect how we build our software and how you run your businesses. So when we think about Windows 8, our strategy for Windows 8 is to embrace the devices and deliver the experiences that you love. If you look at the last 10 years, you've seen a whole new set of devices, everything from the iPod to the iPhone. We now have things like iPads and slates. And so it's no longer just laptops and desktops. It's a wide range of devices. And so part of our Windows 8 strategy is to embrace the entire stack, regardless of size, everything from mobile phones to slates, et cetera. And we want to focus on delivering great experiences. And so when it comes to security, sometimes security gets in the way of the experience. But as you've probably noticed, we've done a lot of work to make sure that doesn't happen. BitLocker is, I think, a great example of an encryption product that really, really runs behind the scenes and doesn't get too much in the way of end users while providing a lot of protection. So the end user experience when it comes to security is critical. And then the other part of our strategy, in addition to embracing devices and delivering great UI experiences for users, is making sure that they're enterprise ready. And of course, we've done that for a long time. Now, Windows 8 offers what we consider kind of a no-compromise tablet experience. So we wanted to make sure that as we move towards the tablet that we didn't lose security capabilities on that. And so the same security capabilities that we have on the laptop and server, et cetera, are equally applicable with some exceptions based on the form factor. Sometimes the security features don't make sense for that type of device. But all of those that make sense exist there on the tablet, et cetera. And so I mentioned earlier a series of flexible work styles that are how we're organizing the features and that we're focusing on. And this is effectively the list. Productivity on tablet obviously is obviously a major theme. We've redesigned the UI, as you've noticed, to address that space. So that's one of our areas. Metro style enterprise apps, so moving away from traditional apps to a new modern type of app, a full screen app where all the Chrome and extras are hidden and your workspace is the hero rather than the tools, working anywhere. And I could kind of go through the list, but of course we're here to talk about security. And so end-to-end security is one of our top priorities. And I should mention actually, when we look at the volume of resources that we've put to bear on security and we compare it versus 7, the total spend and the total headcount applied to security in Windows 8 is more than it was before. And because I think the nature of the threats have changed since 7, the severity of the impact has changed, and we want to lead on security. And so you'll see as we talk through some of the features, specifically in 8, that this is a very large jump in capability. So in this slide here, I just want to kind of get, it's a pretty high-level slide, just to help you understand kind of the journey we've been in, it's kind of a credibility slide, to be honest. And it's about, what we're trying to express here is our experience in data center, right? Because the more experienced you are in using, managing, et cetera, a data center, the more you learn, right? And the great thing about Microsoft is it's a big company, and so we have a lot of services that customers are using, and of course we've learned quite a bit just by doing what we call dogfooding our own software. And our data centers work closely with the product and engineering teams to share their learnings, and we deliver features that satisfy their needs as well as externals. And so our first data center, obviously, in 1989 was there. MSN, a big service. Hotmail, another big service. And then we had Windows Update, which is, of course, supporting millions and millions of users. And then GFS, which may be something you don't know about. And GFS is our group who's providing the data center services for our own groups. Xbox Live is involved in that group. Everything on Windows Live, GFS supports that. So we're talking about a huge, huge data center. A lot of expertise comes to that and is going directly into the engineering groups. We have online services and, of course, Windows Azure, obviously something that's new. And that's we're building huge data centers there. So we have the experience of data centers to know what types of features are required in the enterprise. And as you look over time, you'll see that we've learned a number of things. We had the Security Response Center back in the 90s, but I think the big date there is kind of early 2000s, which was the Bill G memo. For those who remember Code Red and Slammer and these things, you remember that was the moment where we're like, oh my gosh, our entire business is at risk because of the security issues that we weren't prepared for. And so we literally turned an aircraft carrier on a dime, and I think you'll see that we moved very quickly to address those threats with SP2, and security became the top priority in our operating systems moving forward. So that's our journey. And kind of where we're at more recently is now that we understand security, the importance of it to a degree that we didn't know in the 90s, we now are embracing a lot of the certifications. I mentioned earlier that governments are getting involved in this quite extensively in issuing new certifications. And so we're working very hard with them to make sure that we are not boxed in by some of these. Oftentimes, when governments pass legislation, suddenly we're in a bind where we as a community can't achieve our security goals. So we have a very active community working with the government to make sure that the legislation that's passed here in the U.S. and internationally allows us to continue to deliver secure software that's usable, manageable, et cetera. So from a security landscape perspective, there's two things that we want to apply our security strategy to. We need to manage and secure the devices themselves that you're using and of course, the applications. And so those are the two big buckets that we think about. And when we organize our thoughts around, okay, what are we going to do for each of those, there are kind of three key categories that we're going to address. The first thing is we want to protect and manage the apps and the devices against threats. Threats that come from within, external, internet, intranet, et cetera. So regardless of where the threats come from, the user, the device, et cetera. We want to focus on those. And so that's one of our key pillars, our key areas that we're investing time in. The next thing we want to do is we want to protect sensitive data. We want to make sure that the data, the user data on the device, the corporate data is all secure. So we're talking about things like encryption. And then we want to secure access to resources. So when a user or device is attempting to access resources locally or remotely, we want to make sure that we have the proper authentication, maybe multi-factor, single factor, whatever makes sense, using identity. And we also want to make sure that we have the right access control on the resources themselves. And so we have quite a few advancements in each of these. And I think throughout the deck here, you'll see that. You know, part of the challenge that we have is we move into the cloud. We have the private cloud that we've kind of had for a while now, and now as we move in the public cloud, that offers a whole new set of challenges. And so when we're designing new features in Windows 8, or Server 2012, et cetera, we need to think about both of these key scenarios when we're trying to protect things. So we just mentioned the kind of three categories that we have. And in order to achieve our ambitions for the future, something that we know now, and we've actually known it for quite a while, but sadly we couldn't execute it on it, is we knew that software alone was not going to be able to enable us to solve our security problems, right? Because if there's something that can boot or start before you, a bad piece of hardware, a bad piece of software, et cetera, the system is compromised. So in the case of a rootkit, if you have a rootkit that starts before Windows, obviously you're no longer in control. And so in order to solve that problem, we need to go beyond software. And so we've worked over the course of the last, maybe 5 or more years trying to get the ecosystem to deliver the hardware. And so one of the major advancements that we're going to have is what we call Universal Extensible Firmware Interface. And so this provides a number of benefits to Windows and systems, but from a security perspective, it's going to offer one big one. And that's going to be the ability to have a secure handoff between initialization of the hardware and the first operating system loader. Today, malware inserts itself in the MBR and redirects to itself, and then it starts Windows. And so with UFI, we can make sure that the first software that starts is the software that you wanted, not the black hat who maybe tried to put malware on your system. The next part of our strategy is TPM. And so TPM we used in Windows 7. We used it for BitLocker, but we didn't use it extensively beyond that. That was really the only feature that used it. The result of that was that the cost of the TPM chip was considered expensive. Our OEMs mentioned to us that it might be about $10 per PC, and when you look at the cost of PCs that people are buying, they can be as low as $400. If you're familiar with the margins on a $400 PC, that's all of the margin. So they just don't include TPM in that device because it's way too expensive. Now, luckily, in the commercial space, it's there. So we're seeing most commercial devices have TPM technology. And we're now going to actually see that actually start showing up in consumer devices as well, because we've worked with the TCG, who owns a specification for TPM, to help it address a couple of concerns, one of which is that the fact that the TPM chip is expensive, so and the reason why is only BitLocker uses it. Now we're actually going to see a broad range of Windows features taken advantage of it, probably over 10. So there's now more demand for this capability because there's more benefit. And we're also addressing a regional concern. So has anybody here had, do any of you have customers or users in China or Russia? So a lot. So we have a lot of international businesses here. And so if you're familiar with TPM, which has an embedded encryption algorithm within it, cannot be used in those regions. China and Russia have encryption algorithms that they prefer. Russia uses ghost standard algorithms. I'm not sure what China uses, but because TPM has a hard-coded algorithm, effectively, it can't be used in those regions. And so what we find with BitLocker customers is when they go to China and Russia, they actually turn off encryption, and now all of their data is at risk, or they use devices that don't have TPM, which is a bad thing, too. So as we worked with the TCG to address this concern, we introduced with the TCG, through our feedback, a feature called Encryption Agility. Encryption Agility will allow the OEM to put in an encryption algorithm of choice. So PCs sold in China and Russia theoretically would include the encryption algorithm baked into the TPM firmware itself, and then it can be switched out. So this allows it to be an international capability, and because of that, the costs will go down as well. The last thing that's interesting about TPM is TPM can now be virtualized in Windows 8. If you have a connected standby device or a device that uses a system on a chip, such as ARM or our Clover Trail, there's actually a security component on there that has the characteristics from an anti-hammering and security perspective of a TPM, and we virtualize a TPM in that space. So that drives the cost down to zero, and as a result, TPM will be used in actually as a certification requirement for all connected standby devices. So TPM will protect you in the commercial scenarios as well as some consumer scenarios. And so, anyway, as we move on throughout the life cycle, we expect TPM will be pervasive across all domains, commercial and even commercial, and that will offer a whole new set of security capabilities to customers. And so when we think about the features and capabilities of protecting against threats, I'm not going to go through the litany here, but I think what we're trying to express here is Microsoft's strategy has a broad range to address those three categories, right? So that's how our mental model works. It's about protecting against threats, sensitive data, and securing access resources. And so we have a holistic, comprehensive view and a set of technologies, as you can see listed with the logos below, to protect you across all those domains. We have capabilities that are in Windows. We have capabilities that are complemented and helped managed by AJ's team, System Center and Server, to be able to make those manageable technologies as well. So we do have a comprehensive set of capability. So now that you get the kind of high-level view, let's talk about kind of the approach and let's drill into actual technologies themselves. So every piece of software that we deliver at Microsoft goes through a very rigorous process that we call the security development lifecycle. This is a lifecycle that is made public. You can actually learn about it yourself. So if you're a customer who has its own development team and you're building your own software, they absolutely should be familiar with SDL because this will help them deliver secure code that keeps your environment safe. Microsoft uses this process, and so does everybody else. I would expect a company like Apple, Linux community, would go to this resource because it's not really a Windows resource necessarily. This is just the right practice for delivering secure code. And effectively, it's a life cycle that includes training, security requirements and mentalities, implementation, tools, etc. And so I think the way to kind of sum it up is here at Microsoft, the way we use it is we train, every single one of our employees is trained on how to deliver secure code. They understand the requirements, and then they actually, as they start designing specifications to the program manager at Microsoft, they design the plan for our software, and then it's actually vetted with a team that's assigned to each of the product groups, and they actually vet that design. So you can imagine our components being in a Visio diagram, and we actually do a threat model analysis on each one of those components. And these experts who are experts in exploits, et cetera, and vulnerabilities, they can help us make sure the design is right, so it's more secure, and the code is more secure as well. And so we learn quite a bit in that process, and the end result is more secure code. We also use tools. So once we have a good specification, once we have a secure process and secure code, we actually have tools that are in Visual Studio to make sure that we can look for things like buffer overruns and these types of things. So we do a lot of static code analysis to make sure that mistakes aren't made. We look for APIs that are deprecated and these types of things. And so the end result is a far more secure set of software that we're delivering. And all our teams at Microsoft have to take advantage of this process. And actually, we do it eagerly, to be quite honest, because security is a top feature for every product team. And so this is how we lead. So I'd like to bring AJ up, and he's going to talk about how we start the process with configuration management.
Thanks, Chris. So Chris mentioned a lot of basic details on how we develop a secure way of developing software and few high-level strategies. Before we go to Windows 8 specific security features, we did want to give you the strategic level of, regardless of whatever operating system you have, you still need to do these things, right? So first, it starts with patch management or updating your operating system. Whether it is Windows 8, Windows 7, few people are still going to Windows 7. And so updating that system is quite important. It starts with first Microsoft Security Response Center. That's a team of global researchers who work with 70 other protection partners. And they work together to give you early notification of vulnerabilities, early notification on specific updates they are doing. One of the examples that the team has created is a tool called Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. It's a free tool or a free toolkit that is an application hardening toolkit. So for example, if you had legacy applications which had some vulnerabilities and you didn't want to enable some security feature in the operating system globally, then this tool will be able to help you to just make sure that that legacy application is hardened, is protected from those specific vulnerabilities. And it's a free tool, right? So, and a lot of updates, a lot of new security vulnerabilities, reports of that vulnerabilities are given to our partners as well as to you folks through this security response center. The other important thing, obviously, is patching your systems. Every patch Tuesday or whenever it comes through, you do need to make sure that your systems are patched. We have made it easier by having a built-in role on Windows Server, so you can automate that patching in your work environment with WSUS. Or you could further automate it through a centralized management infrastructure and scale it out to your enterprise using System Center solutions. So System Center Configuration Manager fully integrates with WSUS, and you're able to automate that patch management system along with your desktop management system. The graph on the right actually tells you the significant increase in our enterprise customers using these patch management systems. And that is a secure way of updating your systems and making sure that your enterprise is protected. So with patch management, you also want to make sure that you're consolidating your desktop management, your device management. I mean, the client management environment is changing dramatically. You have different devices coming into your enterprise. As Chris was saying, consumerization of IT, the trend that is described as people having multiple devices. So that has brought significant different challenges in your network. The first one is identity management. Having a common understanding of a user who's trying to use multiple devices. I just read a report that said that on an average, one user is having 4 to 5 different devices. So imagine those 4 to 5 different devices on different platforms, requiring different type of applications, different type of management systems. So it's important for us, important for the IT administrators, to understand what the user is trying to do, when the user is switching the context between devices. And so from our perspective, you need to have a common identity infrastructure and common identity management. That starts with Active Directory. Obviously, that gives you a rock center, centralized way of managing those identities, having single infrastructure to define applications, define policies based on what the user wants to do. Then there is other resources like Windows Azure Active Directory services, which with that you will be able to sync between your on-premise Active Directory services and in the cloud services. So if you're using, let's say, Office 365 or Exchange Online, you'll be able to sync your on-premise Active Directory users to the in the cloud services. That's a very powerful thing to do because now you have one set of identity, one set of users that you can manage and apply policies in the cloud or on-premise. And the last thing on identity management is a forefront identity manager that gives you the ability to automate group management systems, automate certificate and PKI enrollment and certificate management. So it's a powerful tool for you to, again, centralize and consolidate your identity management. So once you have identity management, the next step that you want to do is centralize your client management systems. With System Center 2012 Configuration Manager, you will be able to define your, get visibility into all kinds of devices. It gives you visibility, obviously, into your Windows devices with the upcoming service pack that we just announced this week. You'll be able to also manage your Mac clients. You'll be able to see the inventory of Mac clients. You'll be able to see the inventory of mobile devices using Exchange ActiveSync. So all those consolidated inventory will help you to manage those devices, manage those users. We integrate with, System Center integrates with Active Directory, so you are able to define users. And regardless of whatever devices the user is using, you are able to define policies and applications to that user. So when the user switches from, let's say, a Windows 7 device to a Windows 8 device, automatically, Configuration Manager will understand the context and will provide the best experience for that user. So on Windows 8, that user might get a Metro-style app. On Windows 7, he switches back, and that user can get a regular traditional style app. So those are the dynamic settings that you can get through a centralized management solution like System Center Configuration Manager. And lastly, we are talking about security finally here. And so with Configuration Manager, you are able to define baseline settings for all your clients. So you can say, this is my baseline policy, this is my compliance policy, these are the things that I absolutely require on the client, and these are the things that should not be on my client. And through Configuration Manager, again, the value of having a centralized management system, so through Configuration Manager, you can deploy that baseline and also automatically remediate any drift in the compliance. So if there are clients which are not compliant, then Configuration Manager policy can automatically remediate those clients for compliance in your enterprise. What we have done is, through Security Compliance Manager, we actually have provided best practices templates. So you can actually use templates, best practices knowledge from Microsoft, guidance from Microsoft, to actually have those compliance baselines and deploy it using Configuration Manager and Compliance Manager infrastructure. So those are the key things to remember when you are thinking about systems management, patch management, and once you have set that up, then you go to the operating system and enabling different security features inside that operating system. So Chris is now going to talk about what are those security features in the Windows 8 operating system that can help you define protection in your enterprise.
Great. All right, thank you. Okay, so let's start here with a discussion on what we're doing in Windows 8. And this slide here, we're going to take you through a whirlwind tour of all the key security features that we've added to Windows 8. So you should be able to walk away kind of understanding the delta of what we had in Windows 7 versus 8 here. And so I kind of broke it out into a series of categories that kind of go in order of how the user would approach this. And so the first thing is, of course, we've secured the code itself. And we talked a lot about that just a few slides ago with SDL. So, of course, that's kind of central to our process. Now that we've got secure code, let's talk about how we're going to secure the boot process. So in my last session this morning, we talked about two key features that we have. The first feature we kind of talked about a little bit here, which is UEFI. That's not really a Microsoft feature. It's an industry hardware feature that we take advantage of. And UEFI gives us a secure boot feature that allows us to ensure that the operating system loader of interest, the one that you want to load, starts first. But that's not where we start. You know, that will prevent low-level rootkits, things like Stuxnet, which embed themselves in front of the OS, and the many other types of Trojans that are out there. Secure boot is very effective in preventing those from starting because it requires that a operating system loader is not only signed, the signature actually has to be registered in the UEFI's database. And so UEFI will just simply not start an unsigned operating system loader unless you turn off its secure boot feature, which some people will do in certain circumstances. But out of the box, of course, Windows 8 devices will have secure boot enabled. But we don't stop there. We want to make sure that we continue to protect the boot process all the way up pretty close to where WinLogon appears. And so once the secure boot occurs, we know that Windows has started. We continue to protect the process by ensuring that all Windows components that are being loaded in the boot process, all Windows drivers, even the anti-malware driver, which may be from Microsoft or potentially from a third party, we want to make sure all of those start and all of those have maintained integrity. So trusted boot plus secure boot ensures that the entire boot process has been protected. Now, in the event that something happens, a vulnerability is detected, and somebody attempts to attack either the root or possibly the boot process, there are remediation processes built into the trusted boot feature that would make sure that upon the next reboot that those tampered with components or those replaced components would be replaced with safe versions. And that occurs automatically behind the scenes upon the next reboot. The user actually doesn't have to get involved in that, which is quite nice. But IT can report on it through products like Forefront Endpoint Protection, et cetera, in the reporting. So the entire boot process has been hardened. And so these very dangerous threats that we're experiencing today, in some respects, have been eliminated from the threat landscape. Architecturally, we've created the conditions such that malware can't start in the boot, the root process or the boot process. And so this is a big game changer, and I'm sure it's going to frustrate people who like to write these low-level, very sophisticated types of malware. Now that we've securely booted the machine, we're going to secure the core in ways that we haven't been able to do in the past as well. We've advanced that. And so when we talk about securing the core, we're talking about making sure that there are mitigations in place so that if a vulnerability is discovered in the community and an exploit is less likely to be successful in attacking the system. And so we do this with a number of features. One of those features is ASLR. ALSR effectively randomizes memory. And so in Windows 7, we had that feature. And in Windows 8, we've actually increased the entropy, or the randomization, you might say, to make it even more difficult for a hacker to find a place in memory that it can successfully insert its code and get it predictably executed. So on Windows 8 devices, it's going to be very difficult for somebody who discovers a vulnerability to insert their application, their executable code, somewhere in memory that it will be executed. And that's because we're taking advantage of a 64-bit address space. And we're randomizing it with a higher level of entropy than we have in the past. So this is going to be a big deal, I think, and make vulnerabilities less likely to have impact on you. In addition to ALSR, we've now applied, which has been around for a while, primarily on user applications, we've actually added it to cover a broader set of system processes. In Windows 8, some of the core components, kernel components, actually were not completely protected by ALSR, and so people discovered this, and of course, when they found vulnerabilities maybe in one of the core Windows components, that was a place that was unprotected. That memory was not randomized, so it was predictable, and so executable code could be inserted there. So ALSR now applies across virtually all memory, and thus it's far more secure than it was before. We've also added DEP, Data Execution Protection. That's been around since Windows 7, but it's been improved as well. That's now applied, actually, to core system processes as well. There were actually gaps in Windows 7, and now we have more comprehensive coverage. So I think the threat landscape, the ability for hackers to exploit vulnerabilities that they discover, whether it's in applications or in core, you know, low-level components of Windows, are far less likely to succeed than they have been in the past. From a securing the sign-in perspective, we've added a couple abilities, capabilities. You've seen Picture Password, which is a great way to log into a touch device. If you aren't familiar with that, there's a great blog entry that talks about the security behind that. A lot of people are like, oh, Picture Password, how could that be secure? We've done a lot of analysis on that. And there's on Windows 8, Building Windows 8 blog, they go into a lot of detail, kind of at a scientific level, to kind of help you understand how secure that can be. But that is a great way to log into a device. Assuming you don't have a very simplistic picture like a square or something like that, which would make it maybe more predictable to pick out. But at any rate, that's a great new sign-in technique for touch devices. It also, yes, you got it. At any rate, we have another way of signing in that's very interesting. We have a new capability called virtual smart cards. So today, one of the big challenges that customers are running into is they want to use multi-factor authentication, but it's too expensive to deploy. The reason why it's expensive is in the case of a smart card in a scenario, we have a reader, we have a card. The reader and card plus the provisioning cost typical organizations up to about $50. And that's a pretty big number per PC. And when a user forgets their smart card at home and attempts to maybe access the building like we do at Microsoft, or I pay for my lunch with my smart card, actually we do that, maybe you do as well, or maybe actually do real work, is like accessing a server resource or something on a file share. If I forget my smart card somewhere, it's lost, I can't get my job done. And then you're talking about what's my bill rate. I'm a salary guy, but if I had a bill rate, what is that times the amount of time I lose? And if this happens to an executive in your business or some senior people, it's pretty expensive proposition. So the net is a lot of people are not using multi-factor authentication or are using it in limited ways for very specific high security scenarios. And so we wanted to find a way to drive the cost down to as close to zero as we could, and a virtual smart card can do that. So virtual smart card basically takes advantage of the TPM chip, The TPM chip's used to encrypt the certificates which are stored in the KSP that we have today. So the KSP, as you know, is a software store for certificates, and it's exportable if you're a hacker and you know how to do it. And so people don't really like that. And so we now secure the virtual smart cards and other things that, using the TPM, so they're encrypted and more secure. So that's an important takeaway. And then with the virtual smart card, it behaves and acts just like a normal smart card, except the device itself is the, well, my PIN is my first factor, and the device itself becomes the second factor. And so virtual smart cards are effective. They're technically single factor when you're logging on, but when you attach to a network resource, then it does become a true multi-factor authentication scenario. So there's still room in this world for physical smart cards. But for the customers who can't afford to or don't have the need to have that type of scenario, virtual smart cards are a very inexpensive way and add quite a bit of additional security. So we encourage you to take a look at that. In fact, one scenario that our banks are looking at is they've tried in the past to issue smart cards and other devices to their customers, and they've, I think, failed for the most part. Maybe there is one bank out there that, or two banks that are actually successful with that. But virtual smart cards, because they can be provisioned remotely, and you can enroll in it, you can now protect consumer bank accounts with this multi-factor authentication. And so that will prevent the case where a keylogger got your username and password and somebody in another country is emptying your account. So we think this is very promising in that scenario, and there's many, many, many other uses for virtual smart cards beyond just corporate. Now, when it comes to securing the desktop while it's in use, we've made a lot of changes in Internet Explorer and the core. Internet Explorer had a great feature called App Reputation, Smart Screen, which had app reputation and URL reputation. And those were very, very effective in preventing a lot of phishing scams and malware from hitting the PC. But it only protected IE users. And so the time is now to protect all users, regardless of the browser that they're using. We wanted to make sure that Chrome users weren't susceptible to more malware than Internet Explorer 9 users. And so with IE 10, what we decided to do is we've moved that app reputation feature from IE into core. So regardless of the browser you're using, we want you to use IE, but we know you use Chrome, and that's fine. You will be protected from malicious apps coming off of the internet. And we'll show you a demo on that. Now, when it comes to our last area here, securing access to resources, I have a separate slide on that, so I'm actually going to wait to go into detail there. But we've made some changes there, one of which I've already mentioned. Virtual smart cards is a way of securing access to resources. And we have another feature called dynamic access control, which I'll overview towards the end here. So when you combine, the goal here is to help you get breadth across our security technology. So when you combine Windows plus Office, Office introduces some similar concepts as Internet Explorer did. We had like app reputation in Internet Explorer, so IE was obviously a great place for malware to try to get into the system since users use it to download bits. But Office, we found that people were trying to attack users with malicious documents, malicious add-ins, et cetera. And so with Office 2010, we made a number of changes in there that make it far more secure than in the past. One of the first things we did is we added a protected view. So we make sure that rather than loading up any document willy-nilly and hoping it's safe and secure or isn't corrupt, we now actually carefully inspect it before it's loaded, and we protect the user. And I'll show you what some of those screens are like so you can see what the user experience is. We've also reduced the attack surface area. So kind of like what we did with the SDL process, when we applied SDL to Office, one of the attack vectors we realized, of course, was the documents themselves. People were inserting malicious macros, et cetera. They were tampering with the schema of the document itself, so they were changing it and causing faults in the application itself. So we've applied rigorous validation of the schema and the file types, et cetera, to make sure that a document that does not look like an Office document, or one that looks like one that maybe has been tweaked in a way that would allow something to be exploited, we make sure those documents have at least integrity with them and within them. And so, and then there are a number of other features as well. But let's talk about that sandbox capability. And so when you load a document in Office 2010, you've probably seen some of these screens here. And so in this case here, we have a couple of examples where different types of content within the document are prevented from running until you authorize it. So if you receive a document from a coworker that has macros in it, you're probably more likely to trust that because it came from within a trusted user. I wouldn't necessarily implicitly trust it, but it's more trustworthy potentially than something coming off the internet, obviously. So we will give you this, the ability to prevent active content from running until it's authorized. And so you hit the enable editing button and then you have the ability to execute it. Now, what happens if that content appears to be kind of corrupted? Somebody's manipulated the schema, so maybe Office would be able to load it successfully, but we see there's something compromised in that document. We would then give them the ability to prevent it from loading, and that's, of course, the default. Now, you'll notice on the last screen, we allowed somebody to enable editing, so we made it very easy for them to allow that active content to run. In the case where something looks very suspicious, they don't have the ability easily to do that. However, there is a way for them to do that if they want. And so all these settings can be managed in group policy as well. So if you want to prevent users from making these choices, you can. So this is a really important feature in Office. I think it's kind of similar to the concept of what we did in Internet Explorer. Now, I mentioned a couple, and of course this is the Internet Explorer slide. We've talked about a couple features, the smart screen capability. But there are other features that help keep you secure there as well. You're familiar with the feature zones that we've had for a long time. But something that's we've invested more in Windows 8 is we've made sure that IE is less vulnerable and that in a world where we're using multiple tabs at once, that a malicious website in tab 1 is less likely to be able to compromise something in tab 2. And the way we've done that is we've created process isolation across the components. So IE has a main frame that hosts the tabs, and all of the other tabs will run within their own process. And so because each process has the ability to fundamentally kind of protect itself, one tab that has an issue does not have the ability to kind of have a cascading effect across all of IE. So each site could be protected effectively. We've also added cross-site scripting filters in there to prevent that from occurring. And then we're actually applying ALSR and DEP to Internet Explorer, which is something that we hadn't done in the past by default. So so this is less likely to be an exploit on any one of those tabs is less likely to have a successful exploit. So let me show you a couple demos of Windows 8 security. And so the first one I'm going to show you here is with a slate, and it's going to be the Trusted Boot feature, which is... All right, so we're going to go ahead and log in here. I'm using my picture password here. Anybody recognize where that photo's from? No? Giro Italia, if you're a cycling fan. That came from that. It's a great photo. At any rate, so the scenario we have here is let's imagine that I've received a piece of email from a friend. I trust them, and they're like, hey, here's this great application that's I'm using here to solve problems that we deal with every day. You should install this. And so I trust my friend. He's a tech-savvy person, maybe somebody like any one of you, right? He thinks it's safe. But the reality is unbeknownst to this particular friend of yours, behind the background, this installer took advantage of a vulnerability and successfully exploited the system and installed something that affected the boot process. And so I'm going to simulate that here with my little script here. Oops, I ran it in Notepad. That's not what I wanted to do, or OneNote. So like many installers, I elevate privilege to install it. And so what I've done here is I've actually run a script that actually completely has broken the boot process. I've replaced the anti-malware driver from Defender. I've changed the boot operating system loader. I've made a number of changes. And so what will happen is those are going to lie in wait because the boot process requires a reboot before you can initialize any new code. So in a way, this malware is now lying in wait for the reboot. And so when we reboot down the road, okay. Sadly, it's not displaying while it's booting. I had this happen this morning, so I'm not sure what's going on, but I know this is impossible for you to see. But basically, the device is rebooting, and immediately on reboot, it detected that something had been changed in the boot process. So when the operating system loader starts, it does a quick analysis. And so UEFI verifies that it's a secure operating system loader, and then it executes the task to make sure that Trusted Boot can verify that all of the files during the boot process, including AV, are secure. And so the first thing it does is very quickly it says, something's wrong with our file set. Something has been tampered with. It then actually does a further analysis to find out exactly what has changed, and it builds a list. Once it has that list, it goes to WinRE and a capability we call the Windows Side-by-Side Store, which is a secure location where all the Windows boot components, including the anti-malware driver, are stored. It pulls those files out, it replaces everything that needs to be repaired, and then it reboots the process. And you know, I apologize that you couldn't see it, but this happens all automated. So if this happened in the middle of the night, I would wake up the next day, log into my PC, and I wouldn't necessarily know that it happened. From a commercial, from an enterprise standpoint, they of course want to report on this. So something like Forefront Endpoint Protection would have the ability to give you reporting on that type of scenario. So enterprises will be aware. But in this case, you got to remember there was actually no harm on the system, right? Because it required a reboot to become active, and we ejected that malware out of the system before the system booted. So this is a big change. Things like Stuxnet would not be able to survive the boot process. So we've eliminated boot and rootkits from kind of the threat landscape. So now that we're logged on, we of course have picture password, as I showed you a minute. And so the picture password, of course, gives me the ability to use a picture that means something to me and apply a series of gestures to it. I'm able to pick what those gestures are and the photo, as I just mentioned. And so in my particular case, I used the fence as a point of interest. So I put my finger across the fence. I used the part of the mountain is the next gesture. And then there's a pole there that I use as well. So this is an interesting way of logging in. And it's obviously ideal for touch. And it's far more reliable than using a password. If you're using iPads or using password on other mobile devices, you'll know that you fat finger a touch keyboard pretty easily. And so this is a fast and fluid way, just to use some of the marketing terms, and it's a very secure way of logging in. Now, in addition, we have virtual smart cards, and let me just show you kind of quickly the smart card experience here. And so when you log on, you have the ability to choose which sign-in option you want to use. So I have picture password as an option, and incidentally, MSIT did an analysis on it, and they're allowing us to use it here at Microsoft. And I have, that's the first icon. The second icon is my password icon. And the third is the virtual smart card that I mentioned before. So the virtual smart card shows up just like a traditional smart card. And just like a normal smart card, I input my PIN. And I'm able to sign in successfully with the virtual smart card. So that gives you kind of an idea of some of the secure sign-in capabilities. And so let me show you the experience with how we're going to secure the user while they're online with Internet Explorer. Go to number 3 here. Okay, so we have, I'm going to borrow your network connectivity for 1 minute. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Okay. We had one wire up here, so we had to share it. So let's see. Let's make sure we have network connectivity. And so the demo I'm going to show you here is okay, perfect. Thank you. Is going to show you. Let me see here. Let me cancel this real quick. Okay, well, it's gaining network connectivity. So as I mentioned earlier, we've moved Smart Screen into core Windows, right? And so the demo we have is, this is actually a URL out there on the internet, so you could test this yourself if you're using Internet Explorer 10 on Windows 8. We have two applications here. We have Free Video XE number 1, which is a malicious application, and number 2 is a safe application. And so with Internet Explorer, if network connectivity ever comes back to us here,
while you're trying that, I have a question for the audience.
Sure.
How many of you are using Smart Screen or know about Internet Explorer Smart Screen? Few of them. Do you want to talk about the Smart Screen a little bit?
Sure, sure. So Smart Screen has had two capabilities on IE9. It had the ability to make sure that malicious applications were blocked, and it had a phishing filter that would detect malicious website, so it would prevent users from going to known bad locations. So those are the two capabilities. And as I mentioned earlier, we felt that it was not right for us to have a feature like anti-malware capability exclusive to IE9, so we brought it into core. Let me kill the process here real quick.
I got a quick question.
Go ahead. Okay. For app reputation, we've moved that feature out of it and moved it into core. And so, by doing that, if you're using Internet Explorer or Chrome or Firefox, Safari, whatever your browser is, that app reputation capability will protect you in those browsers as well.
Yes.
No, it won't. So Windows 7 will not have app reputation move into core Windows. IE10 on Windows 7 still has anti-phishing and anti-malware. So we didn't backport that functionality into the previous operating system, but moving forward, it will be part of core. And so, anyway, I'm having a bad luck with my demo, but I'll sum it up and then I'll take a question. So what we would have seen if our network connectivity came back, maybe we can show it on here. Google Chrome. Let's see. No, I'm just not getting network. Anyway, what I was going to show you is on Internet Explorer 10, what happens is you go to this website, you try to download the video, and what will happen is IE actually use a web services out there on the Internet, and it will actually block the download from ever happening, which is nice. And that's something that IE 10 does. When we go to Chrome doesn't block the download because they haven't taken advantage of this web service, but Windows, once the download has become local, if a user ever attempts to run it, Windows will prevent it from executing. So the experience is a little different, you know, in my estimation. You know, it's a little better not to download the bits. Okay, finally the network came up. Let me show you then. Okay. Okay, so it's asked me, do you want to go get the binary? And then instantly, before I even downloaded it, it was blocked immediately in the browser, right? So I'm safe. Now, when I go to Chrome, experience is a little different. Kind of seen it already. I'll go ahead and click on it again. You'll see another download comes. So the binary comes local. I attempt to run it, and then Windows gets in the way, in a good way. And it prevents it from being executed. So this is great, and it works across all of your browsers. Now, we also talked about BitLocker. And so one of the things that we're doing in BitLocker is we're protecting you in a new way. Let me go back to the PowerPoint here.
Hey, Chris, you had a question there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you had a question. So go ahead. The answer is you still have the same protection that you had in 9 in 10. So we didn't move it out of 10. So 10 on 7 has app reputation and URL reputation as well. So it's just as good as it always has been. And by the way, statistically, there's some stats from NSS Labs. They did an analysis of the different browsers and RRAP reputation implementation versus others. You're talking about blocking 96%+ of the threats with IE9 and a lot less than some of the other browsers. But because we've moved that functionality now into core, they're less vulnerable. So I think it's a really great story. I think it tells you how serious we take security. We're not going to compromise users because they're using a competing browser. Security is too important for that. Okay, there's the clicker. So let's go ahead and let's talk about endpoint protection.
Sure. So Chris talked about what was inherent in the operating system and how we are making it secure with Windows 8. That's all good. But ultimately, the attack surface is changing. The threats are changing. People are going, you know, to social websites and to other applications that are vulnerable as well. And so you also want to have an additional insurance with an anti-malware agent on your operating system as well. So for Microsoft, that anti-malware agent for the enterprises is called System Center Endpoint Protection. How many of you were aware of Forefront brand? Few of you, okay. So for those who didn't know, Forefront was our earlier antivirus, anti-malware solution. That is renamed, the brand is, the Forefront Endpoint Protection is renamed to System Center 2012 Endpoint Protection. The big change that we made in endpoint protection, we like to call it as we operationalized it. So if you are using your desktop management, then the day-to-day activities that you need to manage and protect your PCs should be consolidated. The endpoint protection or the antivirus activities like updating the signatures, scanning those PCs, all of that can be done by the same team that is managing your desktops, managing your clients. That way, they can also start the remediation quickly, they can start the patching quickly from the same console, and the security team can then think of end-to-end compliance policies and do bigger security things rather than get bogged down on day-to-day activities. So System Center Endpoint Protection is fully integrated with System Center Configuration Manager. I'm going to show you that. And it also includes all sorts of proactive protections like behavior monitoring, like heuristics detection, all those kind of things. And since many of you didn't know about endpoint protection, I just wanted to call out that we have done a ton of research and ton of progress, a lot of progress in providing a very good protection engine that is backed by our global research team. So the global research team comes from Microsoft Malware Protection Center. Because we are updating, patching billion of computers out there, we have great telemetry. We understand what's happening on the clients, understand the new vulnerabilities, and so we are able to provide good protection for all the new vulnerabilities, new threats out there. So quickly, let me show you the interface and the ease of use that we have provided with endpoint protection. All right. This is my Windows 8 client. And on that Windows 8 client, I have deployed System Center 2012 endpoint protection. So any of you use Microsoft Security Essentials? Few of you. Great. Awesome. So as you know, that's our freely available antivirus for your home computers and personal devices. System Center Endpoint Protection uses the same protection engine, which means the same benefit you get from MSE, which is a lot of times people give us feedback that, hey, it just doesn't work. It doesn't impact my performance. I don't even know it's there. That's the same learning we have taken to provide you with protection on the enterprise side of things. So this is the interface for System Center Endpoint Protection. I'm managing it through Configuration Manager console. I can update it manually from here, but generally the updates can be driven through your existing infrastructure, either WSUS or Configuration Manager. And then the settings are managed by the administrator, as you can see here. But I just wanted to give you a small snapshot of what we are able to provide in the protection engine itself. So you can do real-time protection, which is obviously recommended, but it can also provide you with behavior monitoring as well as a network-level protection. So it has different sensors that can monitor the behavior of the system, behavior of the applications, behavior at the network level. If something changes, then A, through heuristics, it's going to protect you. If not, if it says, hey, there is a suspicious activity going on here, then in that case, we also provide you with in the cloud service, which it's called Microsoft Active Protection Service. And so this in the cloud service, this client, if it finds some suspicious activity, can dial back into Microsoft's service, and we will analyze it, and we'll see, hey, this looks like a new virus just came out, and there is a pattern, a signature, a protection available for it. Then without waiting for the regular signature update to happen through WSS or through a Windows update, we can provide this client dynamically in real time a new update. So this in the cloud service also provides you with better dynamic protection. And on the management side, what you have here is, if you're not familiar with Configuration Manager, this is the new System Center Configuration Manager console. And within the console, as I said, it's fully integrated with Configuration Manager. Within the console, you have a node for endpoint protection status. So it doesn't require any additional installation of endpoint protection in your enterprise. You just install Configuration Manager. If you already have it, then you just enable the endpoint protection role on this console, and you are ready to go. You are ready to deploy an antivirus, manage and deploy antivirus solution. And within that console, you are able to monitor the antivirus activities or virus activities in your enterprise. So here, we have made it easy for the desktop administrators. It's all operational. They can click on these graphs, and it actually gives, you know, goes to the actual device that has been impacted, and from that point onwards, the administrator can take immediate remediation. So I can go in here, oh, VNet client was impacted. I can go right-click, and I can start a full scan, or I can force definition download. I can also, I can also go back and check the malware detail, and the same detail can be then seen in the reporting capability of endpoint protection. So it basically gives me a lot more detail on the malware as well as the threat. So if you noticed, when I double-clicked on this, it actually went online, and it will go to Microsoft's Malware Research Center and give you more details on what the malware was, what the threat was, what do you need to do for remediation. Of course, my network connectivity got disconnected here, so...
Sorry about that.
No worries. But it's not... so it may not go to Microsoft right now, but the point is it will give you a lot more visibility into the threat and give you ability to react and remediate those things. So with that, I'm going to hand it over back to Chris to go through the rest of the talk.
All right. Thanks, AJ. All right. So we talked a little bit about how we're going to protect the system and deal with malware threats and whatnot. And we're also doing quite a bit to protect your sensitive data. So we have BitLocker as our solution for encrypting volumes, those that are internal to the system called FixDisk, as well as those that are removable. Won't go into a lot of details there because we're kind of running out of time. I want to make sure we get some questions, but that's part of our strategy is a disk encryption package. It ships actually in Pro, which is something that's different. It used to be an enterprise-only feature. We believe encryption is so important that it should also be available to smaller businesses and enthusiasts even, and so it's now in Pro. From a rights management perspective, we have, of course, IRM, which is something I could have brought up earlier, but made sense kind of in the protecting data slide here, where you can apply basically encryption and rights management to individual documents. And so this, of course, is an important part of the strategy as well. And so what this will happen is I can encrypt my volume and deal with data at rest, and IRM can help me make sure that as the data moves off of the machine that it remains encrypted and protected. When it comes to securing access to resources, we have a number of technologies. We have direct access, and direct access is an effective technology in allowing users to connect to their corporate network and getting access to corporate content. From a security perspective, it actually has a really great benefit, right? It's not just a networking tool. Because it has two channels, one's kind of like the user's channel that they use to go access resources, but the second channel, which is always connected as soon as the PC starts, I can now push policy and patches using direct access. And so this is the best way to keep your PCs up to date. And if you have road warriors or salespeople who rarely come back to the corporate office and rarely connect to VPN because they hate the big payload when they don't do it for a week, direct access is going to solve that problem completely. So this is going to help you drive higher compliance numbers. And the direct access team did a great job in making sure that direct access was more easy to deploy. If you've tried or evaluated in the past, there were steep, steep network infrastructure requirements. And so we've done a lot of work to make it a lot easier to deploy in the actual environments that are deployed today. So take a look at it. If you look at it in 7 and said, oh, I can't change my network infrastructure, it's too expensive, take a look at Server 2012. It's likely that you'll be able to use it this time because it's been designed completely different. We also have network access protection, which is basically prevent machines from logging on the network when they don't have the right security configuration. That's less likely to occur when you use a product like Direct Access, but we still have that capability where you can sandbox machines that aren't compliant. And then we also have a strategy with unmanaged PCs and phones. AJ talked a little bit about that, you know, with System Center Configuration Manager. The UAG gateway allows devices using the browser to access corporate resources as well. One last technology I want to talk about is a big new change. I mentioned modern access control was one of our big bets in 8, and it's going to change the way resources are secured. And so how many people went to the dynamic access control presentation? Not many? Okay, so let me give you a real quick high-level overview of what it is. Today, the challenge we have with securing access to resources, I have a file share, and I connect it to a security group, and I manage who has access by putting members in that group. The reality is in large organizations especially, users move from team to team to team over time. And so what we find is their access continues. As they go from one group to the next, they never lose access to what they had in the past because people don't keep the security groups up to date. And so this is a huge, huge threat, especially if you're in like Department of Defense related type of work. And so dynamic access control is going to move away from security groups as the means to gate access, and we're going to use a rules-based system instead. So it's a complete new way of doing things, and the rules are based on who the user, who the user is, not their name like we do with security groups, but who they are and what they do. What group are they in? Are they in the finance department? If so, yes, they get access to the resources. If they switch to human resources, the second that change happens in AD, guess what? The dynamic access control is up to date, and because they no longer have the properties they used to have, their access control has changed. So we use rules to create conditions such that members of the finance department who report to this manager have access to data that has PII and HBI data. So that's the kind of rules level sophistication you can add. And so it's a complete game changer to access control. It's applicable to file servers is our first scenario, but this is a huge infrastructure investment. So you can see that in the future of Windows that we will apply this type of technology across a broader set of scenarios. But today with Windows 8 and Server 2012, it's a file server scenario. So I didn't have a lot of time to go into details. So we talked about UEFI and TPM quite a bit, so I'm going to kind of move on there. And then this is basically our wrap-up slide. I think that we've covered the breadth of things here. So you can see that Windows is fundamentally more secure than it has been in the past. We have the System Center provides the central command and control, the administration experience to help you keep machines in a compliant state from a policy perspective, from a patch level perspective, et cetera. We have the technologies to keep data secure with things like BitLocker and RMS and IRM and Office. A lot of the new bets we have use existing infrastructure you have. So for instance, Direct Access, rather than requiring you to deploy new infrastructure, is able to be deployed on the network infrastructure you already have. And so that kind of covers it up, and we have not much time for questions, but I have time after this session to continue the discussion. So I'd like to open up the floor to anybody. Lost it. It's all right. It's been a long week.
Thanks, folks.
I've got a quick question about.
Sure.
A couple of questions about the picture password. How are password changes managed? Do you have that password change capabilities every 90 days? Click on a new part of the picture, or
there's policy control on that, and so you can require a reset of that. I don't know exactly. The level of detail that we have there, is it exactly the same as a password? I'd have to double check, but there is the ability to force change on that.
Okay. And related to that, how are past lockouts dealt with? So I come back from a vacation, I've forgotten the swipes I need to make, and I've locked out my picture password. How do you reset that?
So a case where you get locked out of your PC.
Using the picture password sign-on.
Picture password?
Yeah.
It will require an administrator to reset it, and so you have to go through the kind of a similar password reset experiences. So it's basically the same type of mentality as when you get locked out of your own password. You have to have administrative help desk support to reset that.
So I could go into AD, reset the account, or?
I'm not sure exactly what the reset policy is there. There are some slight nuanced differences between the way passwords are handled in the reset experience and the picture password. So sadly, I don't have the answer to that one.
Okay, thank you.
Next question over here on the right. No. All right, great.
Yeah.
You got it. Okay, good.
With the IE10, do you know anything about the ADMX templates that might be available with that and or how many new settings there will be for the security of IE?
I could tell you how many new settings there are.
And more importantly, if there's, let's say, 20,
yeah.
Are only 6 going to be compatible with IE10 on Windows 7?
I couldn't tell you what the delta is in the actual individual settings. I mean, obviously, there's some settings that have gone away. So, for instance, app reputation's moved out. So there's fewer settings there. There's do not track me is a new setting. So there's a few that are new, and there's a few that have gone out. But there is an ADMX template that will contain that. And then you could use, security configuration. What's that tool? There's a tool that allows you to check baselines, and you could actually do a delta check that way. Security Compliance Manager, there it is. So you could use that to check the delta, but I don't have the actual list at this point.
Yeah, I have a quick question over here.
Oh, there. Okay, great.
So if I'm using IDM solution where we're using a password reset, to go along with the gentleman's question before, if I decide to start using picture password, there's a compatibility issue. Do we contact you for help with that, or is there something we need to do? Go to the other vendor, or what do we do?
Yeah, I'm actually having a hard time hearing actually because I have two conversations going.
Oh, okay.
Could you maybe repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Yeah. So we use a product to manage our passwords.
Okay.
We have two 80 file structures that we're using. We're using Open AD, and then we use Active Directory as well.
Okay.
We use that product to control our passwords.
Okay.
So would there be an issue going forward using Windows, if we go to Windows 8 and we decide to start using picture password, and we have the rules set up for every 90 days, like the gentleman said.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So yeah. So the issue would be that, and I'm not familiar with the product you're using,
yeah, right.
But that product had to be instrumented with the knowledge of the password types that exist.
Okay.
And so picture password is a new type, kind of like a smart card was a different type, so there's different policies and settings related to it. So they would have to upgrade their capability to be able to manage that type of password.
All right, and the schema, basically it's just extending the schema within within Active Directory, correct? As far as that attribute being applied to
Well, actually, no. The picture password is actually stored locally. It's not stored in AD, and actually we create a relationship between your password and the picture password. So what happens is your picture password unlocks and basically decrypts the password, which then gets passed through.
Okay.
And so it's a little different. So that means that in order for OpenAD, in order for them to be able to manage that, they would need to client-side code actually in order to be able to manage that. So it's actually a pretty significant change for them. But something probably they're thinking about. So we're working with vendors who have add-ons for AD to see what they can do on that.
Okay. So, thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Hi. I've got a two-part question on smart cards. Our organization uses
one question at a time.
Okay. Fair enough. First question is, actually, we use a product called WinMagic SecureDoc to do pre-boot encryption using a smart card to decrypt two-factor. Does the new version of BitLocker enable that capability? Because I know the previous versions don't.
Correct, right. So the question is, do we allow pre-boot authentication with BitLocker with a smart card, which we don't do on Windows 7? And
correct.
The answer is Windows 8 does not support smart cards for pre-boot authentication.
Okay.
And so I'll give you some insight on why. And so our belief is we're in kind of an in-between time when it comes to pre-boot authentication. And so the reason why we have pre-boot authentication is when you unlock OS volume without authentication, we have to leverage the TPM in that case. And
right.
So the TPM unlocks a drive and then the keys go into memory and then they're stored there. And so the reason why that's a bad thing is the attack vector is to use DMA ports to gain access to memory. And so a hacker would dump your memory, and if they know what they're doing, they can maybe find the obfuscated encryption keys in memory. So the reason why we have pre-boot is to prevent that scenario. It's,
right.
It's not about preventing the OS from booting, although it does do that, but that's not the problem, that's the solution. So that's the background. When we move into the future, we are trying to work with hardware industry to create conditions so that DMA access ports don't exist anymore. And
okay.
So if you look at our connected standby devices, our slates, you'll notice in the specification that they can't get a certification logo unless they have no DMA access ports on it. And so when you eliminate those ports, you don't need pre-boot authentication anymore. So for connected standby, pretty good story. So on existing devices, like laptops and desktops, you will still want to use PIN, and you would like to use smart card,
right.
Which we don't support. And the reason why we don't support is we are trying to move the hardware industry so that we can get rid of pre-boot authentication. And so that's why we're not investing more in that. So,
okay.
Does that make sense in the strategy?
It makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unfortunate for our particular situation, but there's ways we can get around it with BitLocker and using smart card and PIN in other areas for authentication, which is the next part of my question.
Yeah. Let me, before you go there
sure.
is a third-party tool that you can look at that will allow you to use smart cards in pre-boot with BitLocker.
Oh, okay. That's good to know.
I can't tell you what the name of that company is. Do a search and you'll find it. And
fair
so
enough.
That would result in a net decrease in your spend on encryption technology because you already have BitLocker, right, and you're not using it, and so the cost
correct.
Of this add-on is fairly small.
Okay,
we're
that's
not
good to
recommending
know.
It as a, like, we haven't put our stamp of approval, like, oh, this is a secure, great product. We're just aware of it, and so do your own vetting from a security perspective
gotcha.
On it.
Okay. Second part of the question is around the virtual smart card use.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking to adopt direct access via an appliance device,
mm-hmm.
and I know you can enable smart card auth for the direct access connection.
Yes.
Does that go through with a virtual smart
yes.
card?
Yes.
Cool.
And you can set it up so that the virtual smart card basically is pass-through, so as long as once you log in with your PIN, that the you get not just the management layer, which actually happens even before you log in, but you also get the user layer, so when they log on, they kind of get a single log-on experience, whereas a lot of people set up direct access. You log in with your password, and then you go to your like VPN-like client, and you hit direct access, and then
right.
you log in again. You can get single sign-on all the way through.
Yep.
And that's
I spoke
what we
with
do
both an appliance and Gemalto on that 2 days ago and got
okay.
that overview, so that was very cool. The final piece of that is the virtual smart card FIPS 104 140 compliant. That's the reason we're using smart cards for a lot of this stuff is we have to be for some
of the
clients
we're compliant. Using. So the compliance experience happens towards the end of the product cycle, so we design things with a certain intent, and so we're working to make sure that it meets the different criteria, so we don't have an answer yet until
okay.
we go through the testing.
But that's the intention nonetheless, is the direction
it's,
of the technology.
It's always the intention. I wouldn't say it's always the intention. In this case, we're interested in making sure that happens, but we don't know, actually.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
I'm not telling you because I know and I can't tell you. It's like we haven't tested it yet. So
fair enough. Yeah. I mean, we've invested enough in the smart card infrastructure that we'll probably stick with them as opposed to going to the virtualized ones, but it would be interesting to know if that is compliant and we could get away from the physical smart card and just use the devices
absolutely.
That we have purchasing.
Absolutely.
Save us some money.
Yeah. What industry are you in? Healthcare or Fed?
We audit healthcare.
Okay.
And specifically government sections of healthcare, which is why the FIPS 140 compliance is necessary.
Okay, great. And then one last thing I'll just mention. So MBAM, which is the management layer for BitLocker,
right.
would not manage FIPS compliance devices. 2.0 will. So
right.
that's an addition for
okay,
you.
Okay, that's good to know, yeah, because
yeah.
we're using BitLocker in some areas right now, but relying on the smart card authentication at Windows and an RDS session to get the compliance level. So,
okay, great.
Very good. Thank
good.
You.
Thank you for those questions.